You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. This is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm Chuck Coughlin. Welcome. We're going to talk today about the American Catholic schools. There's much in this program that will delight and please you. The mission of Setting the Record Straight is to do one small part in restoring the great and rightful reputation of our beloved Catholic Church, to reveal its magnificent history, never shying away from its faults, but casting a light into the public consciousness of the great historical achievements that resulted from Christ's message being enacted by the Catholic Church throughout the last 2,000 years of history. So much attention in our media is devoted to the faults of the Catholic Church, and it does have faults, but these are endlessly recycled and exaggerated. A false image of the Catholic Church is prevalent in our culture, in our movies, in our TV series, in our books, depicted as a troglodyte, a medieval institution mired in the vestiges of obsolete tradition and rules. It is said the Church is out of touch with the modern times, with modernity, when actually the reason the Church has no use for modernity is because the Church is in touch with eternity. And look around you, modernity has a terrible record. This incorrect perception of the Catholic Church is a firmly imprinted myth, a subset of the great black legend promoted by Protestants in Europe against Spanish Catholicism and the Church in general. There are many people who are not terribly concerned about what others think of us Catholics, but they should be. Our evangelical efforts are greatly impeded by the false idea that people outside the Church have of the history of the Catholic Church. What other institution has an unbroken line of succession for 2,000 years? From the appointment by Jesus Christ of St. Peter as the first pope to our present pope. It's not wrong to be proud of the Catholic Church. We should be proud. The universal Catholic Church is a global network of information sharing, and has been that way over 1,000 years. Inventing the first hospitals and making a network of them, sharing medical knowledge. Inventing the first universities and making a network of those and setting the template for all subsequent universities as places of free academic discussion and forming a nest in which the scientific method and scientific thought emerged, creating the great blooming of Western culture, which is quite unequaled anywhere, and in the arts and in every other area. It is my claim that Catholicism has been the greatest positive influence of any entity in history, just as the Catholic Church has alone done the most to raise the status of women over the past 2,000 years, and to confirm the Catholic Church's conviction from the start that persons of every race, creed, color, and sex had the same status before God. This influenced this great United States of America and seeing persons the same way, the idea of personhood. The sad thing is that all these great achievements are never attributed to their real source, to our Holy Mother Catholic Church. In this program, I'm going to talk about one of its great achievements in education, the Catholic schools, and specifically the American Catholic schools, which are quite a different story than the system of monastery schools, cathedral schools, and networks of universities that were established elsewhere. There's something quite unique and remarkable about American Catholic schools. The most remarkable thing about them, in Catholic educational institutions of every type, is that they ever came into existence at all. When we look around, American Catholics today are strongly middle class, many of them upper class, most of them relatively prosperous and well-educated. But when the parochial school system got underway, most of them were members of the working class, much poorer than other Americans, and many of them were barely literate or not literate at all. Almost everyone has recognized the superiority of the education provided to Catholic youth in the parochial schools, and many non-Catholics entrusted their children to Catholic schools to be educated. since it was widely acknowledged that the scores of the students were superior to those provided in the public educational schools. One result of this is that when you break down the American population by economic status and original origin, and I'm talking about the tendency to hyphenate people as Italian Americans, Japanese Americans, Korean Americans, French Americans, English Americans, and Irish Americans, and correlate this with their relative affluence. Not many people realize that the most successful and wealthy group in the United States is the Catholic Irish American. Don't you think it's only fair that we assign part of that credit to the American Catholic school system? But the American variety of Catholic schools are remarkable. They're very unlike Catholic schools in Europe, Canada, and Latin America. Here, these schools have to be supported by voluntary contributions, without assistance from governmental sources or philanthropic foundations. The chief factor in making these schools feasible at all is what is termed the living endowment. The living endowment, throughout the history of the Catholic schools in America, has been provided mainly by teaching nuns and brothers. Most of these people themselves were the sons and daughters of working class or extremely poor parents. Even with this boon, extraordinary sacrifices have always been required to keep the schools going. Since Catholics also bear their full shares of cost for public education. In fact, they sometimes had to spend more on the public schools that they did not use than on the schools that were actually educating their children. And the vast majority of all state government budgets is devoted to supporting the public schools. Often it amounts at $12,000 to $15,000 per student per year. Where do they get this tax money?
Well, they get it from everyone. From non-Catholic parents, from Catholic parents, and from people that have no children at all. All contribute to this. The parents of children attending Catholic parochial schools
have to pay twice for their children's education. Well, this certainly reminds us of what happened to Catholics in other countries. But there they had no choice but to pay twice. Under the British, part of the penal laws against Catholics and Irish Catholics was as they were taxed to pay the tithe to the Church of England.
This could occur because England was a theocracy through those centuries, and is today.
The penalty not to pay the tithe to the Church of England was often very severe, sometimes resulting in execution and torture. And so it is as the public schools today, where our parochial school children are not even allowed to ride the school buses, because the school buses will only take them to the location of the public schools, will not transport them to a parochial school, even if it's next door.
This lack of subsidized pupil transportation is just one of the many, many factors that held back Catholic schools in this country.
Yet somehow that system has managed to grow to massive proportions, expanding as the number of Catholics increased until slightly more than half the primary school children belonging to the church were enrolled. By the mid-1960s, parochial schools were educating 5,800,000 elementary
and high school pupils,
or about one out of every seven American children. One out of every seven. When you add to this number the several hundred thousand students who were enrolled in more than 300 Catholic colleges and universities, the total figure reached well over 6 million. In all, the Church maintained some 12,000 educational institutions, ranging from kindergartens to medical schools. As I assure you're aware, the number has been decreasing rapidly in recent decades.
By 2001, the number of students enrolled in Catholic school had decreased by almost half. We went from 5,800,000 to about 2,500,000.
With the exodus from the cloister that followed the wake of the Vatican Council, and the number of religious available for teaching has fallen off drastically. To replace them with lay teachers who require normal pay
is proving to be somewhat difficult. Some people say it's proving to be impossible.
Yet there are many fine Catholic private schools that are making it, funded by very reasonable tuitions
and aided by generous donations from private parties. Let me offer as an example one outstanding school in Louisville, Kentucky,
the Holy Angels Academy. This institution educates children from the first grade to the 12th grade. Holy Angels Academy has a tuition for the first child of $5,400 a year. The second child gets over a 70% discount, and the discount continues, and the sixth child can attend for only $100. The Holy Angels Academy does depend on donations for the major part of its support. But the result is amazing. This is a magnificent school. This last year, Holy Angels was once again recognized by Catholic High School Honor Roll as one of the top 50 Catholic high schools in the country. In the past 25 years, Holy Angels has consistently ranked in the top 25 in both Catholic identity and also academic excellence. Many of their students qualify for the National Merit Scholarship Program. 198 scholarships have been awarded to Holy Angels graduates from many different universities, some very fine ones, including Ave Maria University, Bellarmine, Franciscan University of Steubenville, and Transylvania University. Holy Angels shows it can be done. Here's what founder and headmaster Joseph Norton has to say about his school.
The mission is forming and educating young people to be virtuous citizens and to be honorable people. And we're forming them, most importantly, in that vein to end up where they should be, which is eternal happiness in heaven.
You might take a look at their website, holyangelslouisville.com. See what you think. holyangelslouisville.com. More to talk about after the break. See you then.
And we're forming them, most importantly, in that vein to end up where they should be, which is eternal happiness in heaven.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
You're listening to breadboxmedia.com.
This is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm Chuck Coughlin. Thanks for sticking with us through the break. We're going to talk some more about the Catholic schools. We're talking about what happened to the Catholic schools in the United States as the number of teaching nuns declined. Salaries for the lay teachers made it indeed difficult to operate Catholic schools without ample donations from well-meaning benefactors. Just before the break, I cited an outstanding example of Holy Angels Academy, a school that has found a way to make it work financially. But in many, many other cases, tuitions have had to rise. In increasing numbers, Catholic parents are no longer willing to make the financial sacrifice necessary to maintain a separate school system. There's every reason to believe that in the days ahead, the Catholic educational establishment will diminish dramatically. This is sad, since we're involved, since Vatican II, in the new evangelization, a great campaign in which every layperson is called to be involved to evangelize. The most powerful evangelical tool has always been the schools, and that is precisely what we're moving away from.
Who thinks that this is the most powerful evangelical tool? Well, certainly all of the dictators that initiated as their first step in persecuting the Catholic Church the seizing of the Catholic schools. This is the way they initiated their campaign to eliminate the Catholic Church. They wanted to replace the Catholic schools with secular public schools with public schools. In Mexico and everywhere, our enemies looked at our Catholic culture and they analyzed it and they decided what was the most vital point that they could strike first and disable us. It was the schools, the Catholic schools. All this parade of our enemies, these dictators in the mad 20th century, had no doubt about what the most powerful evangelical tool of Catholicism was. It was the Catholic schools. Catholicism was their enemy, and they found its Achilles heel and struck there. What were the Cristeros fighting for in Mexico?
the Marxist Masonic government of Caius as their very first step had seized the Catholic schools, had secularized them. They had replaced the philosophy of the sanctity of life, that is the Catholic philosophy, with a Marxist philosophy of promiscuous sex, the use of abortion as contraception, and the human being as the property of the state. During the Spanish Civil War, the party called Republicans were Marxists, and they seized the schools as a first step. Otto von Bismarck, during the Kulturkampf, the culture war, seized the Catholic schools and made them public schools. In Hungary, the communist government seized the Catholic schools, and Cardinal Manzini fought bravely back, going from town to town and speaking with a megaphone from the back of a truck until he was arrested and tortured and imprisoned for years, until at last he escaped to an American embassy. What did he say from the back of the truck? Don't let them take your schools. Don't let them take your schools. It went on and on. It happened in France in several waves. First of all, they took over the schools. Then they seized all the church property and expelled the Jesuits. It's a repeating pattern in all the histories of the last few centuries. Our enemies know the importance of the schools, even if we don't. The communist governments or fascist governments or Masonic governments' first target was the schools, because they were convinced that it was the Catholics' most powerful evangelical tool. Of course, the academic excellence, which is well documented of Catholic schools, draws people in, and they hear the evangelical message of the Catholic Church. Another reason they're drawn in is the excellence of the Catholic philosophy of life. The Catholic approach to education is better for the reasons that Headmaster Joe Norton just said, just before the last break. Let's talk about the academic excellence of Catholic schools, although that factor is certainly dwarfed by the importance of evangelization and the education of a good Christian. The Catholic schools of the future will probably need to be more specialized, designed for particular needs, complementing rather than replacing public education. In 1884, American bishops proposed the goal of every Catholic child in a Catholic school. But that goal, long ago, was quietly set aside as impractical. It no longer exists even as an ideal. But the tradition of parochial education is deeply rooted in the American Catholic's history, although it took a century or more before the first scattered schools run by devoted laywomen expanded into the parochial system. In the 1700s, Archbishop Carroll was so eager to set up schools in Maryland that he persuaded contemplative nuns of the Carmelite and Poor Clare orders to abandon their strict enclosure and take in pupils. But this attempt, unfortunately, did not work out. The nuns soon returned to their contemplative life and left the work of teaching to other orders of nuns. The pattern that was to endure was first set by Elizabeth Ann Bailey Seton, a genteel New York widow and saintly convert to Catholicism. Elizabeth Ann Seton, in 1809, founded a religious community in Emmitsburg, Maryland. This community was later affiliated with the Worldwide Sisters of Charity. Mother Seton's community flourished. Within a few years, her nuns were founding classrooms attached to parishes in New York, Baltimore, Cincinnati, and other cities. Other women were inspired to follow their examples. Other orders of nuns were actually founded originally in the United States, such as the Sisters of Loreto in Kentucky, or the Dominicans of Sinsawana, Wisconsin. These two orders made teaching their primary work. After groups from abroad, the Sisters of Mercy from Ireland, for example, or Sisters of St. Joseph from France, crossed the ocean to establish mother houses in the New World. They took over the schools, which one parish after another was setting up in order to protect Catholic children from the Protestant public schools. And it's amazing how many books of history of Catholics in the United States leave out the magnificent example of the old Ursuline Convent in New Orleans. That convent building, very beautiful, is the oldest surviving example of a French colonial period architecture in the United States. As a matter of fact, it's the oldest building in the Mississippi River Valley. It was completed in 1752. It's considered the treasure of the Archdiocese of New Orleans. As the pioneering communities of teaching nuns grew, the schools multiplied. The schools encouraged their students to enter the convent, and each year the number of novices increased. The more schools, the more nuns, then the more nuns, the more schools. New orders from abroad sank roots into America, and no matter what their tradition in Europe had been, these nuns took up teaching in parochial schools. At the same time, the original American sisterhoods, growing more numerous, divided and subdivided into separate provinces. In places where nuns were scarce, new congregations were founded by pious girls, working under the direction of pioneering bishops and priests. This growth continued until there were more than 150,000 nuns in more than 200 separate orders throughout the United States. Most of these were actually dedicated to conducting parochial schools and academies. A somewhat smaller group of brothers, particularly the brothers of the Christian schools, the Marists, the Xavierians, the Brothers of the Holy Cross, also took up the work. Though they had to compete with the appeals made for seminary recruits, they attracted enough young American followers to expand beyond their founders' most optimistic hopes. The clerical order specialized in high schools and college training. And this brings us to the Jesuits, the glorious Jesuits. They remained from the beginning, and they still remain, the pace setters. In Europe, the Jesuits were traditionally engaged in providing elitist education for the sons of the privileged. In the United States, Jesuit education at first remained rigorously classical, but the priests themselves stayed close to the working class. In their colleges, tens of thousands of working-class boys were first introduced to the mysteries of Latin and Greek and the world of classical culture. Later, they moved into the professions, forming the nucleus of the middle-class Catholicism which was to come. Most of these schools were set up in the inner cities at first, but they did move to the suburbs, as their graduates had moved there themselves before them and were ready to send their own sons to the Jesuits for a thorough academic training. But how thorough and excellent was this training, really? Well, it's been assessed empirically many times. There was a study called the Nation's Report Card, the National Assessment of Educational Projects, or NAEP. This was a congressionally mandated project of the National Center for Educational Statistics within the U.S. Department of Education. The report was the first to focus on private school students' performances. It provided results in reading, mathematics, science, writing in the year 2000, 2002, 2003, and 2005. It focused on three private school types that combined enroll the greatest proportion of private school students. These are Catholic, Lutheran, and conservative Christians, as well as private schools overall. It compared the performance of students in these schools to that of public school students to provide an additional perspective. Generally, it was found that students in these three types of private schools performed at higher rates than students in public schools. But there were a few interesting differences. I'll tell you about those differences after this break. This is Setting the Record Straight with Chuck Coughlin. Another word from Headmaster Joseph Norton.
We're speaking of training the mind to think in the pursuit of truth. The classical emphasizes what is true, what is good, what is beautiful, what is noble.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
You're listening to breadboxmedia.com.
Welcome back to Setting the Record Straight about Catholic schools in the USA. Just before the break, I told you I would tell you about some interesting results in the survey of the National Assessment of Educational Progress. Comparing performances of students in the three types of private schools highlights several differences. Among the three types of private schools, few significant differences in performance were found at grade 12. But there was an exception. In year 2000, the average score for science in grade 12 students in Catholic schools was 6 points higher than for students, was 6 points higher than for students in Lutheran schools, and that in the 2000 mathematics assessment, a higher percentage of 12th graders in Catholic schools performed at or above proficient, that's a rate, proficient, than 12th graders in conservative Christian schools. The students in Lutheran schools generally outperformed those in conservative Christian schools. Now, students in all categories of private schools had higher average scores in reading, mathematics, science, and writing than their counterparts in public schools. In addition, higher percentages of students in private schools performed at or above proficient compared to those in public schools. The three types of private schools have few differences in their student demographics, except that the Catholic schools generally enroll a greater proportion of Hispanic students than Lutheran schools. There was an article in the New York Times, April 30th of 2010, called Lessons from Catholic Schools for Public Educators by Sam Friedman. The article discussed Diane Ravitch's lightning rod of a book, The Death and Life of the Great American School System. And in that book, there were three references to Catholic education. I read from the article, what subtly informs both our critique and recommendations for improving public schools is in significant measure her long study of and admiration for Roman Catholic education, especially in serving low-income Black and Hispanic students. In that respect, Ms. Ravitch in her book offer evidence of how some public education scholars and reformers have been learning from what Catholic education is doing right. What one might call the Catholic school model is perhaps the most underappreciated influence on the nation's public education debate. Though I guess the point of it is, if you pay attention to what Catholic schools are doing, the fact of the matter is that they've been educating urban kids better than they're being educated elsewhere. Now, here's a key point. I read from the article. When Ms. Ravitch assails the emphasis on standardized testing, particularly under the No Child Left Behind law, and she exhorts schools to use a content-rich core curriculum and emphasize character and build ties to parents and neighborhood, she is, without overtly saying so, extolling the essential traits of Catholic education. Her book on the American school system made the New York Times bestseller list. Ms. Ravitch's interest was initially aroused by the work of James Coleman, a sociologist of education and fellow apostate. Despite his roots in civil rights liberalism, Coleman began arguing in the 70s and early 80s that segregation alone could not explain the achievement gap between Black and white students. His research into various types of high schools, tens of thousands of student records, convinced him that the same kind of poor inner-city Black student performed markedly better in a Catholic school than in a public one. Coleman particularly singled out Catholic schools for their emphasis on the core curriculum and for the social capital they built by involving parents and parishioners. Ms. Ravitch did criticize vouchers and charter schools. The track record in Milwaukee, which had vouchers and a school choice program for upwards to a decade, has shown her no substantial improvement for low-income non-white students. A personal comment here is that almost no voucher programs, and I think this is true in this case, give the proper amount of money as a voucher. If the expenditure in a public school is $15,000 per year per child, then that should be the amount of the voucher. Generally, these tests of voucher programs are for smaller amounts, a third or a fourth of that, which is not proportionate. So it's not a fair test. If parents were given a $15,000 a year voucher for their child, they could send them to one of the finest private schools in the United States. That would be a true test. The truth is that the public school system overhead is extensive and absorbs most of that amount. She also criticized charter schools, though the New York Times reporter felt that this partly arose from Ms. Ravitch's desire to protect Catholic schools. already reeling from a shortage of priests and members of religious orders as teachers, already losing enrollment because of rising tuition and falling aid from parishes, urban Catholic schools face direct competition from charters, which as public entities are free. She writes, where charter schools are expanding, Catholic schools are dying. But charter schools cannot do the same thing. The Catholic schools have a well-established records of being effective, and they're being replaced by schools that have no track record. In the last segment, we discussed Catholic schools, how they started out in the inner cities. Sometimes Catholic universities or Catholic colleges started immediately adjacent to these inner city schools. When the schools moved to the suburbs, these universities often moved away too. But pay attention to how early these institutions were founded. And note that they were founded precisely in the working class areas. These colleges that I'm talking about actually developed into such institutions as Marquette, St. Louis, Detroit, and John Carroll Universities, all still conducted by the Society of Jesus, along with Fordham, the Loyolas in Chicago, Los Angeles, and New Orleans, the University of San Francisco, Boston College, and a dozen other institutions of higher learning. The Jesuits don't have a monopoly on this. On a smaller scale, other groups of priests have also established colleges and universities. DePaul in Chicago and St. John's in Brooklyn were established by the Vincentians. Colleges and seminaries were attached to almost all the large American Benedictine monasteries. What about the Augustinians? They began Villanova University outside Pittsburgh. The Holy Ghost Fathers opened Duquesne, also in Pittsburgh. The Premonstratians established St. Norbert's College near Green Bay, Wisconsin. And the Dominicans took over Providence College in Rhode Island. Manhattan College in New York was started by Christian Brothers, who also started St. Mary's in California. The Marianists started the University of Dayton. The secular clergy also turned to education and still conduct such colleges as St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota, St. Ambrose in Davenport, Iowa, and Bellarmine in Louisville, Kentucky. And what about schools for girls? Well, dozens of the academies and finishing schools run by the nuns gradually did develop into colleges for girls, many of them lamentably lacking in educational distinction, but a few with excellent reputations, such as New York's Manhattanville, Washington's Trinity, and St. Catherine's of St. Paul, Minnesota. There is a university supported by the entire church in the United States. It's the Catholic University of America. It was founded by the nation's hierarchy in the 1880s. But unfortunately, the Catholic University, as even its most ardent defenders will freely acknowledge, did not succeed in matching the glowing vision of its founders. It never achieved the eminence of a Harvard or a Yale, or even some of the other Catholic schools that now outshine it, particularly Notre Dame and a few of the Jesuit institutions. Let's talk about Notre Dame. Notre Dame is the iconic American educational institution. It's a symbol of Catholic education in the United States. How did it start? Well, an impoverished group of French Holy Cross Fathers. They set up a small college in the Indiana wilderness in 1842. The University of Notre Dame began late on a bitterly cold afternoon of November 26, 1842, when a 28-year-old French priest, Reverend Edward Sorin, and seven companions, all of them members of the recently established Congregation of Holy Cross, took possession of 524 snow-covered acres that the Bishop of Vincennes had given them in the Indiana mission fields. He named his school in honor of Our Lady, the University of Our Lady of the Lake. Its football team is known as the Fighting Irish, and the Irish-American community has a tremendous identification with Notre Dame, supplying many of its students. It was a bit odd because it started out being called Université de Notre-Dame du Lac, a French name, a French priest. How did it happen that it became so identified with the Irish-American? Well, no doubt it was because great numbers of Irish immigrants were flooding into the United States in the late 1900s. And soon Notre-Dame was flooded with Irish-American students. It was the Irish diaspora. And here come the Irish, here come the Irish, because the Irish were coming in great numbers to the United States. And in the celebrations before Notre Dame football games, they still call out, here come the Irish. And who has a better fight song than Notre Dame? You know it well. We have much to be proud of in our Catholic academic institutions. But there's always a few problems. In this year, the Cardinal Newman Society of Reporters covered cultural and institutional threats to faithful Catholic education. This included the U.S. Supreme Court marriage ruling, problems with Common Core, Planned Parenthood's close ties to Catholic colleges, ongoing HHS mandate lawsuits threatening religious freedoms, and scandalous commencement speakers at Catholic colleges. Yet many faithful Catholic colleges and schools have responded with vigor to the current challenges and demands of our modern society. Classical education was on the rise this year. Many schools and dioceses incorporated morality clauses to ensure stronger Catholic identity. Pope Francis's Synod on the Family reaffirmed parents as the primary educators of their children, and numerous Catholic colleges and schools chose to steadfastly protect and defend their religious freedom and identity. After a quick break, we'll be right back. This is Chuck Coughlin on BreadboxMedia.com.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit BreadboxMedia.com.
Thanks for coming back and sticking with me on this discussion. This is Chuck Coughlin on Setting the Record Straight. And as you know, you're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. Thank you so much for that. Check out the rest of the programs. There's some amazingly interesting things going on the station.
Well, we've been talking about the Catholic schools in the United States on Setting the Record Straight. Let's go on with this rather interesting subject.
You know, I had that experience of attending Catholic schools for the first 12 years of my education. And it certainly did give me a sense that although I embraced my Protestant contemporaries, that we Catholics were a breed apart, going to our smaller schools. And whereas the school bus came down our street, picking all of my friends up, taking them off, my sister and I waited at the end of the block at the corner at a bus stop for a public bus and paid our nickel fare. And it took us down to the main intersection of town, Main and Lime in Lexington, where we got out along with all the other little kids. I was 6 years old. She was seven. This was the 1940s during the war. And it was a very safe place. No one ever worried about us. Nothing ever happened to a child. We were at the main intersection of town, just a half block from the freight station of the railway that bisected the town. And we would walk the two blocks up to St. Peter's School. We would have begun the school day with daily mass, our knees suffering on the bare wooden kneelers, the church dark except for the light around Monsignor Ennis. And we had a low mass, a mass that took about 20 minutes. Then we began the school day. And then at the end of the day, walk back, wait for the bus, talking to everyone, and ride home and get out at the end of our block. Completely safe in the main intersection of town. All of the people that worked and owned the businesses along the way, watching out for all of us. No one ever worried because nothing ever happened to anyone. The very evident morality of people of that time caused such a contrast to today. We've certainly experienced a great degradation in the moral behavior of our society.
Why were we Catholic children a separate group? My other kids, the other kids on my block arrived in their yellow public school bus, which was free, and for which my parents were paying taxes to support their transportation to their school. It didn't seem fair, but it's a complicated problem. It's difficult to make it fair. Many people have wanted to change to this policy, some understanding to untie the knot of this problem, because it involves a lot of principles. It involves the legal status of parochial schools in the United States, which supports a public school system.
It's never been completely solved. From the beginning, the first and foremost issue was the right of church schools to exist at all. It was not definitely settled until 1925, when the Supreme Court struck down as unconstitutional an Oregon statute that required parents to send their children to public schools between the ages of 8 and 16. The Oregon legislation was directed against all private schools. Its primary target was the parochial school system. The authors of the statute based their formal case on the need for children to be instructed in the principles of patriotism, as defined by the government, and the necessity for the state to avoid the possibilities of young persons being trained to subvert the nation's political or economic system. Had the law been allowed to stand, full-time Catholic schools would have been outlawed in Oregon, and perhaps elsewhere, if similar legislation were drawn up by other states. Since the issue was brought to court by a group of Oregon nuns, the case went down in history as Pierce versus the Society of Sisters. In an historic decision, later called the Magna Carta of the parochial school system, the Supreme Court declared that the act, quote, unreasonably interferes with the liberty of parents and guardians to direct the upbringing and education of children under their control. Rights guaranteed by the constitutions may not be abridged by legislation, which has no reasonable relation to some purpose within the competency of the state. The fundamental theory of liberty, upon which all governments in this union repose, excludes any power of the state to standardize its children by forcing them to accept instructions from public school teachers only. The child is not the mere creature of the state. Those who nurture him and direct his destiny have the right, coupled with a high duty, to recognize and prepare him for additional obligations. Well, this decision not only ensured the continuance of parochial schools in the United States, but put the court's imprimatur on a central point of traditional Catholic thinking about educational matters. For American Catholics, the court's words, "the child is not the mere creature of the state," became the most treasured of the judicial findings. I have to note that elsewhere in the world, we've seen a rollback of this. To give a little historical perspective to this, the whole idea of nations is a relatively new one in recent centuries. And since the founding of the concept of nation, it's always been a source of conflict that the nations wanted to define individuals as basically the property of the state or a creature of the state. This has always been in opposition to the basic Catholic doctrine that we're all children of God.
And we're all the property of God, as is all creation, including the state.
It's interesting to speculate on Christ's answer to the question about paying taxes.
He said, "Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's."
What a multi-layered response that was.
Since everything in the universe belongs to God, including Caesar.
In any case, after the parochial school's right to exist was firmly established, the argument about their claim on public support got underway in earnest. It went on for years, leading to such heated exchanges as the one between Eleanor Roosevelt and Cardinal Spellman. Both sides in this perennial dispute invoked the First Amendment, one claiming that parochial schools had a right in justice to share in the public funds allotted to education by virtue of the free exercise of religion clause. The other side, Eleanor Roosevelt's, claimed that since the avowed purpose of parochial education is to relate religion to every other discipline, public support is permanently foreclosed by the anti-establishment clause. When the Supreme Court has dealt with the issue, it has always put its emphasis on the latter point. A goodly number of American Catholics over the years have agreed with the court, as John F. Kennedy apparently did. But the Catholic community, by and large, especially after World War II, continued to press for support, claiming that parents who send their children to parochial schools are exercising both their claim on religious liberty and a personal right. And a personal right specifically recognized by the court in that earlier case, Pierce versus the Society of Sisters. Catholics should not then be penalized by having to support two school systems to do so. The argument, though, has never been accepted by the court. John Courtney Murray, who shaped a very sophisticated version of the standard Catholic argument in a book, We Hold These Truths, acknowledged that it has never been easy to determine where legitimate government support of religious freedom ends and where illegitimate establishment of religion begins. At the conclusion of his book, he states his realization that clarification of this constitutional issue
would have to be reached through ad hoc legislation in the years ahead, step by step.
Father Murray wrote this before any significant number of parochial schools were being shut down for lack of funds. Since that has been happening, there's been increasing support in the community at large for keeping the Catholic system afloat by providing it with a measure of public support. And in some states, grants have been made for the purchase of books and other necessities. This change of heart is understandable in view of the fact that if all the Catholic schools operating in 1970 were closed down, $9 billion would have been added to the taxpayers' burden. Ironically, however, the present receptive attitude towards state aid is coming at a time when American Catholics themselves, in their eagerness to assimilate into a secular society, seem to have less and less enthusiasm for the very idea of parochial education.
So this is the American Catholic parochial school. More than any other force, these schools strengthen Catholic determination to hold the line against religious indifference, to resist the breakdown of the old Christian culture, and to counteract the force of modernity. In this age of ecumenism, acceptance of the contemporary world, and the notion of the servant church, however, we've been given a new task. The big question facing Catholic education at this point is to determine precisely what the new challenge is and whether a separate school system is the best way to meet this challenge. The big question facing Catholics at this point, who are engaged in a great campaign of new evangelization, what is a more powerful way to evangelize than by having a widespread Catholic parochial school system? What better way is there to defend ourselves in the war against Christian belief that is being fought with such fervent energy by the scientific materialists, the atheists and the agnostics, who would remove every mention of the shared, though unacknowledged, Catholic heritage? The best of our culture was created in the Catholic culture that was spawned and nurtured by the Catholic Church in Christendom. The Catholic culture of Western Europe developed for 1,500 years upon the principles given by Christ to be held as precious treasures within the Catholic Church. At present, the population of the United States is 26% Catholic. Even the other 74% has been enormously influenced by the European Catholic culture.
That is a direct result of the Catholic faithful enacting the gospel of Christ. That was directly conveyed to them within the nurturing arms of our Holy Mother Catholic Church. So here on Setting the Record Straight, I'm Chuck Coffin. I've been offering you a few of my thoughts and reflections on Catholic schools in the United States. They did the best they could with me.